Hail and welcome. My last essay discussed what I referred to as the dialectic of Christian fascism, a contradiction within certain threads of modern Christianity which drive those threads in an increasingly fascist direction. To be precise, modern Christianity emerged over the course of history through a series of concessions to state interests, including concessions to the capitalist mode of production, and as capitalism has no values beyond the value of money, it undermines Christianity even as it is endorsed by the Christian establishment. Another of my recent essays, written in collaboration with Cora Howell, discussed recent trends in evangelical Christianity targeting members of the LGBTQ community. In this essay, we'll see some striking and deeply troubling parallels to Germany in the 1920s, parallels which should be of grave concern to anyone who doesn't want to see genocidal fascists take control of the most powerful economy and military in the history of the world. The word fascism has gotten worn almost to the point of meaninglessness in the current political climate, but it's important to recognize that it does refer to a distinct and dangerous ideology which can be described and recognized, and which is fully illegitimate as a political philosophy. Fascism is authoritarian ultranationalism, often with a highly racist component, devoted to a mythical past justifying social hierarchies with authority vested in a strongman leader. I'm not going to go into the specifics of how this definition emerged from historical analysis of fascist regimes. Feel free to take it as stipulative. I believe this definition is the clearest, most useful, and most accurate one for a number of reasons, but I won't be arguing those here. So just understand that when I refer to fascism in this essay, I'm referring to this specific form of authoritarianism. Hail and welcome to A Satanist Reads the Bible. If you're new to the show, I welcome you to quite an eclectic exploration of philosophy, religion, and cultural theory. This month is all about the growing threat of Christian fascism in the West, which we explored last episode and will continue to explore in this one as well. This show is supported by my patrons on Patreon, who contribute a small monthly amount of money to help offset the costs of doing this project. Research materials, the time to do the work, recording equipment, and so forth. Patrons get access to special features such as the Discord server and help me keep this show free and independent. I hope you'll stop by patreon.com/asatanistreadsthebible to learn more. No new patrons this week, but my dad did send me some money by way of supporting this project, and I think that deserves a thanks. So thanks, Dad. Much appreciated. And thanks as always to all of my patrons, past and present. And now back to today's essay, German Parallels to American Fascism. Let's start with some history, beginning with the administration of Otto von Bismarck, the German statesman who presided over the unification of Germany, which concluded in 1871. At the time of unification, the international situation in Europe was enormously complex. The Holy Roman Empire, a unifying political force which had lasted a full 1,000 years, having been dissolved only a few decades prior in 1806. The result of unification was the German Empire, which included the lands now controlled by Germany and much of the land to the north and east, as well as a chunk of France called Alsace-Lorraine, but not Austria or Switzerland. Bismarck himself was Prussian, Prussia being the historical state comprised of northern Germany and those parts of northern Europe later included in the German Empire. And his objective was the creation of a Prussian nation-state, a single empire unifying the Prussian peoples as one. The formal unification of the states is a complex matter that I won't be going into. More important for our purposes is Bismarck's attempted unification of the people through the creation of scapegoat enemies, specifically liberals, Catholics, and socialists. His message was that Prussians were united as one people precisely in their opposition to their enemies, enemies who just so happened to fall within Bismarck's general contempt of liberalism, socialism, egalitarianism, and modernism. Bismarck engaged in a culture struggle which aimed to place the Catholic Church under Prussian state control. Fearing opposition and diminishing influence, the church ultimately turned against liberalism in order to curry favor with Bismarck. At the same time, the unification of Germany brought several minority groups, among them Danes, French, and Poles, under Prussian dominion, groups whom Bismarck sought to Germanize through imperialist policies such as settling their lands with ethnic Germans. The unification of Germany was part of a broader trend of consolidations across Europe, and as states unified into empires and grew in power, fear grew of other empires which were doing the same. A complex web of alliances began to form, and contests over territory resulted in skirmishes and small wars. On the 28th of June, 1914, Gavrilo Princip assassinates Archduke Franz Ferdinand of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the city of Sarajevo. Austria-Hungary declares war on Serbia in response, Russia mobilizes to defend Serbia, and decades of building tensions explode into World War I. Writing after his experience in the Napoleonic Wars, the Prussian military strategist Karl von Clausewitz described warfare as a totalizing force. He had originally planned his book, On War, published in 1832 and still read in military academies throughout the world, as being a general guide to military strategy. But in the course of writing it, he came to a realization about the nature of war and set to work rewriting his book as a general philosophical theory of war. He did not live to finish the revisions, but the completed Book One remains one of the most influential texts in human history. He writes, "War is an act of force, and there is no logical limit to the application of that force." Clausewitz had seen Napoleon bring the full force of the state to bear in wars of unprecedented brutality, but could have no hint of how his thesis would play out in the next century when the modern forces of industrialization were brought to the table. It is impossible to overstate the shock and horror that Europeans experienced in the face of total industrial warfare. To people not all that far removed from the Middle Ages, it was simply beyond comprehension. And this failure to comprehend led to unprecedented casualties, as military leaders reliant on victory through the classic stratagem of the heroic charge led wave after wave of soldiers out of the trenches to be mowed down by that perennial symbol of modern warfare, the machine gun. Then came the Russian Revolution and the Red Terror. Seeing the Bolsheviks' seizure of property and the imprisonment and torture of their political enemies, German liberals sided with the authoritarian German government in order to violently suppress the threat of socialism and communism. The war ended in Germany's defeat. The German people, humiliated and brutalized, saw their civilian government as having failed them and unable to protect them from the rising threat of communist Russia. The shocks and brutality of the war left them nihilistic and yearning for a clear and powerful source of meaning. The costs of the war impoverished all of Europe, a burden which fell on Germany most strongly, leaving the German people in destitution. The resulting economic instability led to an increase in crime and the widening of the gap between rich and poor. Sentiments of nationalism and hatred, which had fueled the war effort, left the Germans feeling bitter towards other nations, and they wanted for clear enemies to blame for their misfortune and whom they could eliminate to usher in a brighter future. They wanted to find among their leaders a new Otto von Bismarck who would take charge, unify the people, and crush their enemies. Clausewitz famously stated that war is the continuation of policy by other means. In his History of the Interwar Period in Germany, Richard Evans states that the Germans turned to politics as a way to continue war by other means. In this sense, violence was legitimated as a political tool. Up until at least the beginning of the First World War, racism and anti-Semitism were not mainstream ideologies in Germany. Evans makes the point that a time traveler who arrives in Germany in, say, 1910, and informs them of the genocide that their state would perpetrate against the Jewish people would be met with total incredulity. What? Us? No, that's not possible. We're not at all like that. You must be thinking of the French. Certainly, Germany had its prominent anti-Semites, such as the composer Richard Wagner, who died in 1883, and Friedrich Nietzsche's sister Elizabeth, who edited her brother's writings to bring them in line with the pan-Germanic anti-Semitism to which Nietzsche was viscerally opposed. The victory of German racism arose not from its harnessing the existing racial prejudices of a nation, but rather from its bringing a fringe ideology into the mainstream and tying race to completely unrelated social ills, national humiliation, economic instability, and the alienation caused by modernity. The economic parallels to the contemporary United States are particularly striking and are important to keep in mind because the misleading term National Socialism has led people to believe that the Nazis were socialists, which was very far from the case. It's a point worth making more in depth, but Hitler or the Nazis being at all socialist in spirit is prima facie absurd, given that Karl Marx was ethnically Jewish and that it was Germany's Social Democrats who had signed the Treaty of Versailles, which Hitler saw as an unforgivable defeat and humiliation. Indeed, the German Workers' Party, which later became the National Socialist German Workers' Party, popularly known as the Nazi Party, had co-opted socialist terminology specifically in order to lead the working class away from Marxism and towards nationalism. In a speech delivered in Dusseldorf in 1932, Hitler explicitly connected his social Darwinist and fascist views to capitalism. The Nazis were in no way socialist or oriented towards the political left and were, in fact, violently opposed to both. After the war, the strategy of the newly founded Weimar Republic to pay back war debts resulted in an initial period of inflation, followed by a dramatic period of hyperinflation. Industrial companies, already enriched by the war, used the opportunity to consolidate their power through large mergers, which formed some of the largest companies in the world at the time. They used their control of capital to finance the acquisition of more capital, knowing that, by the time the debts came due, the monetary value of the debt would have been nearly erased by inflation. These companies then used their power to prevent the state from intervening in the economy, as such interventions would weaken the companies, empower the people, and reduce the bottom line. Considered along the spectrum between socialism and capitalism, Nazi economics are, in many ways, the worst of both worlds, with corporations and the state collaborating to control and brutalize the populace, even as neither is truly in the hands of the people. It's worth noting at this juncture that America is already seeing the deep integration of corporations and the state, even as the corporations themselves remain fully private. An article written for the excellent Lawfare blog, Platforms at War by Elena Chochko, describes how platforms, social media companies, and information brokers like Twitter and Facebook now deal with geopolitical and security problems which were traditionally the sole purview of the state. Meta, the company which owns Facebook, has a literal war room dedicated to managing their technology in the context of the Russo-Ukrainian war. And in 2017, Facebook, quoting here from Chachko's article, contributed to mass atrocities in Myanmar and Thailand by failing to stop incitement to violence on its platforms, end of quote. This has terrifying implications. If history continues to repeat itself, we'll see a fascist state with access to more information about its populace than all past authoritarian regimes combined, along with artificial intelligence technology, which can be combined with the vast data caches and harnessed to establish new forms of control with an unprecedented degree of power. Returning to Germany, at the same time corporations were persuading the government not to intervene in the economy, the power of the mainstream press was substantially weakened by what were called boulevard papers, cheaply printed tabloids featuring sensationalist news, some of which were funded by capitalists like the wealthy businessman Alfred Hugenberg. The focus on crime and political scandal increased the perception among the populace that German society was in decline. This perception was amplified by modern trends in culture like the Dadaist movement, which turned to nonsense as a reaction against the cold logic that had brought the world to World War I. Though they were intended to reflect the increasing incomprehensibility of the world, citizens saw such movements as themselves exemplifying or contributing to that very incomprehensibility. Modernism clashed with the cultural sensibilities of the nationalists, who had grown a kind of cult around the spirit of 1914, the spirit of fervent nationalist heroism with which Germany had opened the war. The nationalists wanted to lose themselves in the cultural myths of Wagner, not try to puzzle their way through the alien atonality of Arnold Schoenberg and Alban Berg. Jazz music, with its improvisation, danceability, and unconventional rhythms and harmonies, written and performed by Black Americans, was seen as being even more dangerous. Dangerous to what, exactly? Most centrally, so-called family values. Feminists had made great strides in Germany and elsewhere during and after the war, with women's suffrage enacted in Germany in 1919. Freud's focus on the unconscious, rather than moral motives of desire, had freed people to think about sex in a new way and to free themselves from what they saw as outdated social restrictions on sexuality. Also in 1919, the Institute of Sex Research opened in Berlin, run by Magnus Hirschfeld, who had been campaigning for LGBTQ rights since 1897. Among the clinic's services were early forms of gender transition surgery, and Hirschfeld advocated for the public and legal acceptance of trans people in terms of their true gender identities rather than their birth genders. When the Nazis started burning books in May of 1933, the Institute's library was the first to go. Evans notes that this campaign was not purely driven by, quoting, crude moral conservatism, but also by labor concerns. Germany had lost 2 million men in the war and saw births in decline afterwards. Certainly the threat of a shrinking labor force was on the minds of Germany's wealthy elite. You've probably already noted the number of parallels between the history of interwar Germany and the contemporary situation in the United States. We have in both the idealization of a conservative authoritarian leader, Otto von Bismarck in Germany and Ronald Reagan in the United States, who comes to be seen as having presided over an almost mythical period of prosperity and national strength, followed by economic instability in the wake of failed war efforts. We see in both an intense and pervasive fear of shifting cultural values, particularly with regards to the morality of sex and gender. We see the liberal establishment, both in state and industry, work with and concede to the authoritarian right against movements from the political left. We see a media environment saturated and corrupted by information pollution, sowing fear and uncertainty. We see failed attempts at insurrection to install authoritarian leaders, which nevertheless succeed at pushing back the boundaries of acceptable behavior in the political sphere. We see the dehumanization and demonization of historically and systematically oppressed minority groups, and the establishment of a legal framework encoding that oppression into law. We see the scapegoating of these groups as endangering the traditional values threatened by modernity in general, and the exploitation and weaponization of fringe ideologies of hate by political leaders who normalize violence and insurrection. Recall that anti-Semitism was not a mainstream ideology in Germany until after the First World War. It only took a few years of calculated political maneuvering on the part of the fascists to popularize it and bring it out of the fringes and into the mainstream. In Germany, this culminated in the Holocaust. But we don't know yet where the progression will ultimately lead in the United States. If we're looking to match up the timeline, I'd estimate that we're separated from Germany by almost exactly a century. The general situation in the States in 2023, along with the political rhetoric and the activity and strength of the country's fascist movement, lines up with that of Germany in the early 1920s. This is not to say that 2020s America is identical to 1920s Germany. There are many key differences, and even absent those differences, the similarities do not necessarily tell us how those things are going to progress in the long term. I am trying very hard to avoid being alarmist, both in this work and in the various conversations I have with people about this topic. I can't predict the future, and I do not claim certain knowledge about how the American political landscape is going to play out over the next few decades. However, I think that there is more than enough cause for concern and for taking a strong anti-fascist stance now and not waiting to see whether things will get worse. At the minimum, we have a situation in which the emergence of a fascist American state is a real possibility, and that is reason enough to sound the alarms. What is to be done exactly? I have to admit, I'm not entirely sure. It's a complex and intractable situation. But I want to at least offer something which I hope will get the conversation started as to how we might go about turning things back in the other direction. Not that my own platform commands a large audience or is known for being a revolutionary thought leader, but we all do what we can. Fascism is not merely an idea among other ideas which can be debated and defeated by rhetorically demonstrating its harmful and irrational nature. Fascism is a rejection of the entire notion that ideas should be debated at all. You don't beat a fascist at chess by playing chess, because the fascist is going to ignore the rules, sweep the pieces off the board, shoot you in the face, and declare victory. To suggest that such strategies should be tolerated in the name of fairness or democracy is to fundamentally undermine both. You beat fascists at chess by making sure they don't even get into the building where the game is being played. The first objective of the fascist is to be recognized as another player on equal terms with all others. Once that happens, they are free to subvert the system to their own ends, and then fairness means what they want it to mean, and everyone else has to play along. In this sense, American democracy has already conceded several major defeats. If we continue with our chess tournament analogy, the fascists are already in the room and playing games according to their own rules. Those affiliated with extreme right-wing rhetoric and any calls for the legal oppression or extermination of any minority group must be removed from office and prevented from holding any public office in the future. Of course, anyone who suggests such a thing will immediately be met with the response that this is a democracy and you can't just remove your political opponents from office. but this is what must happen. And it must happen peacefully. The moment blood is shed or violence employed, it will be used as an excuse to expand state powers, exactly as happened in Germany with the Reichstag fire. Calling the United States a democracy stretches the definition of the term somewhat, but even if it were the most democratic state in history, that still wouldn't be an excuse for allowing fascists to hold office, and in fact, such a thing is inexcusable. The present situation in which government officials are enacting legal oppression and calling for violence against minority groups of its citizens cannot be justified by recourse to procedure, to democracy, to the law, or to the Constitution itself. Even the most minimal description of the state entails the protection of its citizens from fascist regimes, which by definition shunt their populace into a state of war. That state, which fails on that account, is no longer legitimate and must be deprived until the matter is corrected. No taxes, no work. I'm afraid that the best time to start organizing for a general strike would have us striking at this moment, but the second best time to start is now. Given my somewhat meager following, I'm hardly the person to organize such a thing, but I hope my listeners will keep an eye out for the right opportunity to start or join in a movement of total refusal. Beyond that, have you ever been in one of those conversations with someone where they said, well, if I were in Germany in the 1920s or 30s, I would have... Well, to any Americans listening to this, you are in fact in a country in which genocidal fascists are very close to taking power. Start thinking about what exactly that means and start preparing. That's all for today. This is the first month in a while I've been able to get two episodes out, and I'm hoping to send another one your way before the month is out. June, as I mentioned last episode, is a bit up in the air because of my pending relocation. A Satanist Reads the Bible is written, produced, edited, and scored by me with the support of my partner, my patrons, and my audience. Glad you could join me. And until next time, always Satana.